It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, October 15th, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. On the rocks, the Biden administration is reevaluating the relationship with Saudi Arabia after OPEC cuts oil production.
This decision worked to the benefit of Mr. Putin.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. A little more than 3 weeks to go until midterms, and voters are already voting in some places as races come into sharper focus. The latest Fox News power rankings paint a clear picture of the stakes.
We have the Republicans with an advantage in the House, picking up 231 seats. However, we also have 16 toss-ups in our whole equation as of now.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. We will take action, President Biden said this week about Saudi Arabia, a longtime ally and partner in the Middle East. The Saudi government chairs OPEC Plus, a group of nearly 24 oil-producing countries. The group announced a cut of 2 million barrels of oil a day over the strong objections of the U.S. The Biden administration says the cut is unnecessary and, worse, only benefits Russia, an OPEC Plus member, reaping revenues to fund the invasion of Ukraine. Relations between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. have always had some bumps, disagreements over human rights and terrorism, and lawmakers from both parties have from time to time called for halting arms sales to Saudi Arabia and raised concerns about the fighting in Yemen. But those calls are gaining traction, and this week President Biden endorsed the recalibration, ordering his team to consider changes to the partnership. A partnership, by the way, that goes back decades. A mutual defense agreement between the U.S. and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was first signed in 1951. John Kirby is the National Security Council Coordinator for Strategic Communications. A retired Navy admiral, he previously served as a spokesperson for the Pentagon and the State Department. I asked him about what a new U.S.-Saudi relationship could look like and if politics was at play in that feud with OPEC's gas price decisions.
Nobody's talking about tearing the relationship apart or doing away with it. There are 70,000 Americans that live in Saudi Arabia, and we have U.S. troops there. And, we've been helping with their self-defense. What we believe, in light of the OPEC decision, is the responsible thing to do is to take a look at the relationship and make sure that it's adequately serving our national interests. And I won't get ahead of the president on this. To the degree there will be changes, we're not there yet. And the president wants to have, amongst his team and with members of Congress, a meaningful contextual conversation about this bilateral relationship and what it should look like on the other end.
Are those changes diplomatic, military?
I think the president's going to want a comprehensive discussion about this with a range of options. And some of them could include military options, diplomatic options, economic options. Arms sales are certainly going to be, I think, part of this.
That's a congressional action, right? Congress would have to sort of
certainly need cooperation with Congress on that. But again, I'm not forecasting that. I'm just saying that he wants a full range of options to consider as he thinks through what this relationship ought to look like in the long term.
You talk about in light of the OPEC Plus decision. Was there an ask made in that visit to Saudi Arabia, which I know was not solely about oil? It was about a wide range of issues. But was there a conversation and understanding when the president left that OPEC Plus was not going to make this decision to cut production?
The president said himself when we were in Jeddah that they did talk about energy security as part of the conversation, both in the bilateral meetings with Saudi Arabia as well as the multilateral meetings in the Gulf Cooperation Council, and that, you know, he said he was cautiously optimistic that there could be some good decisions coming in. And as we sort of after we left, there was an increase in production followed by two decreases in production. But you're right. The trip was not all about oil. That we didn't go. And we said beforehand we weren't going with the expectation that we're going to come out of that trip with some sort of oil production deal. But we did, of course, in light of the price of oil and gasoline, not just in the United States, but around the world, we certainly wanted to have that discussion with them.
I'm sure you saw the statement that the Saudi government put out through their embassy here, that sort of suggests that the ask was to put off this decision a month? Was that what the
Because of...
I mean, that's raised questions, obviously, with the timing as it relates to the midterms,
there was
right?
nothing yeah. at all okay. related to the electoral okay. calendar in the United States. That is just not true. We did ask the Saudis to postpone this decision okay. because we believed, I mean, at a time right now where the predominant challenge is supply on the market, that we did not believe, mathematically speaking, that this was the time to okay. take supply off the market. And we urged them to, if they wanted to reconsider a cut, to do that at their next meeting. And their next meeting is later in the fall.
Okay. So it was more tied to that next meeting.
It was tied to their next meeting. Yes.
Is this really about Russia? I mean, is the worry here that this benefits Russia's war machine, because the price of oil obviously means that they can sell it for more for the buyers that remain?
Yes, absolutely. Russia,
because the market is not as strong for the Russia. I mean, Russia is not selling oil to nearly as many places as it was.
But they are profiteering off these high prices. And so, yes, very much, we've said this, that this decision worked to the benefit of Mr. Putin. By having a cut in supply, you increase the demand signal. Therefore, you can continue to demand higher prices. And what we're trying to do is get that those prices down and get a better balance between supply and demand.
Why is this a reconsideration after the OPEC Plus decision? There have been critics of the Saudi government for a long time in the U.S. relationship with the Saudi government as it relates to the kingdom's human rights record, as it relates to the war in Yemen, certainly the Jamal Khashoggi killing. Why is this the event that sort of says, let's rethink this?
The president said when he came into office that it was time to recalibrate and rethink mm-hmm. the Saudi relationship. This is not a new idea for the Biden administration. But certainly, this renewed effort here that we're going to take, this new consideration of options, is coming in the wake of the OPEC Plus decision. The second production cut, mm-hmm. by the way, not just this. This isn't the first one. It's the second one in a row. And the president believes that now's a time to take another look. And we'll see what comes out of this. I mean, we're just now starting these conversations inside the administration when members of Congress are back in town. A lot of them are out of town right now because of the election. When they're back, we'll continue to have that discussion with them as well. He wants a fully considered, very candid, forthright discussion of options.
The other thing that the Saudi statement indicated is that, you know, OPEC's not a unilateral organization. There are a lot of countries in OPEC, and this was a decision that was made by all of them. Why is Saudi Arabia's relationship with the U.S. sort of being singled out here?
Saudi Arabia is the chair of OPEC. They wield enormous influence in that body, in that cartel, OPEC Plus. And we heard from more than one OPEC country that they were dissatisfied with the ultimate decision and felt coerced by Saudi Arabia to go along with it.
And so this would sort of be an influence on the other side. I mean, this would be a way then for the U.S. to sort of counter that influence that you've heard from other countries.
It's not about countering their influence in the cartel. Okay. I mean, we're not a member of OPEC right. Plus. They're the chair of OPEC Plus. This isn't about countering their influence mm-hmm. inside OPEC Plus. It's about making sure that this bilateral relationship serves our interests and those of the American people.
As we look at the broader region, what does the relationship with Saudi Arabia mean as it relates to our understanding and our response to what's happening in Iran?
In Iran, we have been very clear that the way the regime is treating protesters is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And we have already begun to hold the regime and the regime's arms accountable to that. We will continue to do that going forward. No problem in the Middle East gets easier to solve if Iran has a nuclear mm-hmm. weapon, including the turmoil inside Iran. It benefits nobody that they are allowed to achieve a nuclear weapon. So clearly we want to make sure that that doesn't happen. The president still believes diplomacy is the best way to do that. But right now, we're not focused on the Iran deal. We are too far apart with the Iranians right now. We are focused on making sure that the regime is held to account for the way they're treating innocent
people. So there's no imminent announcement on a renewed Iran nuclear agreement right now?
No, there is not.
What role do the Saudis play in sort of that diplomatic outreach to Iran? Obviously, they have their own concerns about
they sure
what's
do.
Happening in
they're
Iran.
They're not the only nation that has concerns about what Iran is doing.
Absolutely,
And, earlier this year when we felt like the Iran deal was moving in a better direction, we were certainly having conversations with partners, to include Saudi Arabia, about Iran. In fact, Iran was on the agenda during this last trip by President Biden to the region, both in the bilateral meetings with Saudi and in the GCC. The GCC is likewise concerned about where Iran is going. Separate and distinct from their nuclear ambitions, Iran continues to improve its ballistic missile program. Iran continues to provide material support to terrorist groups, whether that's Hezbollah or whether that's the Houthis in Yemen. And the Houthis in Yemen pose a direct threat to Saudi Arabia. That's why we have contributed to their self-defense. That's why we have a small footprint of U.S. military there. I mean, we're mindful of that. We're not going to take our eye off the ball when it comes to Iran and the challenges that they pose. And you can do two things at once. You can take a fresh look at your bilateral relationship with Saudi Arabia, which the president believes is deserved, and still continue to focus on the threats and challenges that Iran poses.
If I may, a little bit of news as it relates to North Korea. What can you tell us about, I don't know, it was pretty provocative, these fighter jets that flew pretty close to South Korea, this barrage of missile tests. Do you see any significance in what this foreshadows about testing and the capabilities of North Korea?
Every time he tests, every time he launches, him being Kim Jong-un, he learns and he can improve his capabilities. And that, of course, is concerning to us. We have treaty commitments to the South Koreans as well as to the Japanese. We have tens of thousands of U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula who are, as we say, like to say, trained to fight tonight if they have to. So these provocative actions are obviously of concern to us, which is why we held an emergency session at the UN, chaired that earlier this week, to condemn these actions. They are violations of UN Security Council resolutions, and that's why we also conducted a series of exercises of our own with the South Koreans and with the Japanese. And we're working with both countries to improve trilateral cooperation between the three of us militarily, because while we have offered, and it was a serious offer, still remains a serious offer, to sit down with Pyongyang with no preconditions to try to find a diplomatic way forward here, while we have done that, we still have to make sure that militarily we are ready to address any challenge to our national interests and those of our allies. And we're going to do that. We are going to make sure that our troops are well-trained, that they have the resources and the capabilities that they need to defend themselves and our interests. And that's why we're going to continue these exercises.
A lot on your plate. I appreciate you taking some time to walk us through it.
My pleasure.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox & Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
This week, the Fox News Power Rankings updated us on the midterm field. 4 Senate seats are still considered toss-ups in Georgia, Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Nevada, though some eyes are on Ohio, North Carolina, and New Hampshire. In the House, 31 seats are considered toss-ups, and one seat that polling has drifted Republicans' way would be a game-changer. Rhode Island's 2nd District has been held by a Democrat for about 30 years, and now former Cranston, Rhode Island Mayor Alan Fung, a Republican, is ahead in some of the polling.
We will win this race, and we will make history and bring back a Republican voice, not just in Rhode Island, but a Republican voice in all of New England, where there's not a single one of us in the House right now.
He says he's focused on the issues, inflation, the economy, energy costs, but that's what many Democrats in toss-up districts are doing, too. Michigan's 8th District Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, who's running in the 7th, has not focused on abortion as much as other Democrats have. She said this past week at an event in Corunna, Michigan.
I will work with anyone on either side of the aisle if they are there to work. I am not there for a Twitter star. I'm not there for someone who just wants to bomb through. You want to work? You're from the left, the right? Let's get to work.
And while generic polling has flip-flopped between voters favoring Democrats and Republicans, some polling in swing districts and of independents has Republicans happy about their chances. Pennsylvania's 8th District Republican candidate Jim Bognet told the Fox News Rundown this past week.
My prediction to you is that in the closing weeks, the 1-2 punch of inflation and crime is going to deliver a victory to the Republican ticket.
And while it is clearly an issues-driven election, candidates matter, and Democrats remain hopeful, especially many incumbents, given the tight landscape.
Just to let you know what the benchmark is so far for us at Fox.
Bill Hemmer is co-host of America's Newsroom on the Fox News Channel.
Is that our power rankings as of this week And we're going to update these every Tuesday for the next, 26 days, right? Mm-hmm. We have the Republicans with an advantage in the House, picking up 231 seats. That would easily be over the majority of 218. However, we also have 16 toss-ups in our whole equation as of now. If Republicans were to sweep those toss-ups, you could go as high as 149 seats, if my math is right. Right? 147. My math is wrong. Hang on. Yeah, that's right. 247 on that. You could also subtract that amount, and you could make the argument, and we can talk about this. If you take the 16 seats away, you're below 218. Therein lies the question. Can Republicans do what many people expect them to do in an off-year election? Here's my view of the House. I think things a month ago, at least according to most folks in the media, that Joe Biden had some wind at his sails and his approval rating was popping up around 45%, which is still considerably low for a midterm election. You really want to be at 50% or above to give your party a fighting shot. And I think over the past 2 weeks, if you follow this every day, you can see that the landscape has shifted. And I believe that's the case in favor of Republicans. And you've got some very interesting races that we can talk about where you can find that evidence. With regard to the Senate, we believe as of today, Democrats are solid in 47, Republicans are solid in 49, and we have four critical states that are truly considered toss-ups. So when you see us on TV, those would be the states, Jessica, that are in yellow, undetermined.
And Bill, you know, OPEC cutting oil production, the latest CPI data showing inflation is higher than expected, and that core inflation number going up, not down. As we hear all of this, people are already voting, right? In many places, whether that's early voting in person or by mail, these sort of big news headlines, I imagine, help one party more than the other.
I think if you are the party in power and the inflation is at a level that's as high as it has been since 1982, that does not play in your favor. Every poll that we have done, we find that some version of the economy is front of mind, whether it's the economy in general, whether it's inflation, whether it's food prices, whether what you're paying for in terms of shelter and rent and housing costs, all that has gone up considerably. And that's on the mind of voters as we canvass the country, no question.
And the power rankings, I mean, things came into a clearer focus this week, right? And I just want to head to the Senate side. We're looking at four seats that are really those toss-ups, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. But if we're going to drill down and talk about flipping power, where are Republicans most hopeful? I imagine it's Nevada or Pennsylvania, given the polling data and some of the storylines coming out of Arizona and Georgia.
Yeah, I would say just going in, if I think the easiest way to understand it is Pat Toomey was a Republican senator from Pennsylvania, and he retired. So if Mehmet Oz were to win over John Fetterman, that would simply be a hold. So Republicans in that sense would not gain any ground when it comes to controlling the Senate. Similar situation in Ohio. Rob Portman retired. If J.D. Vance were to beat Tim Ryan, that would be considered a hold as well. In Wisconsin, Ron Johnson's been in two really tough races. He's won both of them. Right now, he's favored to win yet again over Mandela Barnes, a 35-year-old African-American out of Milwaukee. So all three states, even though we've talked about them every day, that would simply keep Republicans at their number of 49. So then you go looking to find, well, where are you going to flip one? And I should mention North Carolina, East Coast closing time. Ted Budd is in a tight race with Sherry Beasley. But again, that's a state where Richard Burr retired as a Republican and Ted Budd is trying to hold the seat. So yeah. Now you see how difficult this is, right? So I would direct your attention to Georgia. Can Herschel Walker pull it off against Raphael Warnock? Remember, they need to get to 50% in this, based on the state law in Georgia. If he were, you're at 50. And that's if you hold Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina. So now you're 5 for 5. 1, 2, 3, 4. Now you're 5 for 5, right, Jessica? So could Don Boldock, running against a weak candidate in New Hampshire and Maggie Hassan, could he pull out a victory? He could. But let's say the Democrat holds on there and she wins and maintains the hold on that seat. If you were to go out west in Nevada, there's a really good race with Catherine Cortez Masto and the Republican Adam Laxalt. The economy is very important to voters in that state. If Laxalt were to flip that seat, then you would have, based on the scenario I just laid out, you would have 51 votes in the Senate if you consider Walker a winner in Georgia and Laxalt a winner in Nevada. You can mess with this thing 100 different ways, literally. And that's why we designed the software to be able to show it to viewers on election night.
And we're that's a very important point, right? We're playing the horse race game right now. It's November 8th is where it's at. But let's talk about the House. The power rankings have 31 toss-ups now, and I'll just go over a couple of them. Ohio's 9th is now lean Democrat. Republicans have sort of, I guess, abandoned J.R. Majewski there over allegations that he fibbed his military record. Michigan's 3rd, where Republican John Gibbs, backed by Trump, pushed out the incumbent there, Peter Meyer. One of the few House Republicans who voted to impeach the former president. And now that's a lean Democrat seat. On the flip side, though, Bill, we have Maine's 2nd District. That's now a toss-up, Democrat Jared Golden's seat. And the 34th in South Texas is now a toss-up, even though after redistricting, the power rankings note that area would have gone for Biden by, I think, about 15 points. As much as this is an issues-driven midterm, when you hear races like that, candidates really matter.
They do. And I'll just go back to the original point I was making at the beginning of our discussion. That is, well, follow the money. There was a piece this week in the Washington Post. Henry Olson wrote it. And I think he stated it as simply as could be. And that is this. Republicans are spending money in districts where they should not be competing. And Democrats are spending money in districts where they should not have to be competing. And I point that out because these little shifts day to day can give you a little bit of a signal what's happening inside these campaigns and what voters are starting to focus on. The other issue I'd bring up is this week we had a candidate on from Rhode Island. His name is Alan Fung.
I saw that.
You saw that. So he's the former mayor of Cranston, Rhode Island. It's just southwest of Providence. And, well, Joe Biden, I believe, carried his district by at least 13 points 2 years ago.
Wow.
But there were two recent polls that showed Alan Fung up by 6 in one poll and by 8 in another. And there was a reported internal poll on behalf of the Democrat, Seth Magaziner, that had him down 4 points. If your internal poll shows that, and the public polling suggests that Fung is in a good position, meaning he's outside the margin of error in the polling, that's in a district that Joe Biden carried by 13 points and leans 13 points Democrat, closes early in the night. That's one of those races, Jessica, where when you come out on election night, you want to say, just keep your, it's 6 o'clock on the East Coast. Just keep your eye on this district here in Rhode Island. We haven't talked about politics in Rhode Island in more than a decade, right? I mean, the governor, the last Republican governor was 11 years ago. The last Republican senator was 14, 15 years ago, back to 2007. But those are the early indicators that would give you a suggestion that Republicans would be off to a good night. If Fung loses, then that argument is flipped on its head. That's what I'll say today.
And to that point, Bill, Fung aside, what other, I guess, areas, maybe even a specific House seat, are you paying attention to? Because I keep reading, Pennsylvania 8th or Michigan's 8th, where Slotkin is right now, but that's where Dan Kildee and Paul Young are gonna fight it out. And that's a toss-up seat, too. Are you paying attention to those particular seats for any reason, or are you looking somewhere else?
I would point out a few. Those are all really good to watch. Pennsylvania 7 and 8 is in the northeast corner. That's Scranton and Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. We'll see which way they go. They were Trump territory for a while. Biden flipped a few of those counties in 2020. But I would point out a few others just for the sake of the conversation. I would look at Virginia. They close early, 7 o'clock. I would look at Virginia 2. Elaine Luria is a Democrat who's being challenged by a pretty good candidate in Jen Kiggins. That closes early. They count fast. There's two others in Virginia that I keep an eye on. Virginia 7, Abigail Spanberger, the Democrat, is trying to win election for a third time. She's had two very close elections. She's in a slightly more favorable district for her. But Yesley Vega, pretty good candidate, and the Republicans is challenging her. Then there's another one. Republicans have Hung Cao, who was born in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, came to the U.S. in the late 1970s. As his family fled Ho Chi Minh City in April of 1975, all indications are that he's running a really good race. If he were to pull that off, that would be another one of these harbingers we would look. I'll give you another one. In Florida, Congressional District 27, Maria Salazar, the Republican, is running for re-election. She's had very tough races there. However, Florida has turned increasingly red election after election. I would expect her to win. If she doesn't, that would be a canary in the coal mine for Republicans that night. I could go on, Jessica, but I think maybe I'll just wait for your next question.
I was going to ask you, are you in a rush? Can I ask you a few more?
Absolutely. Not a problem. Okay. I don't want to be long-winded, but I want to give you a sense of like what we're trying to study so that we can best be prepared come election night.
Yes, I love it because I need to be prepared too. So, Bill, to that point, let's just dial it up on independence, right, in these toss-up districts, because there was a poll out this week, a CNN poll. It found that while Democrats had the edge over Republicans in the generic ballot, specifically in the toss-up districts, Republicans have a five-point lead. What do you make of that differentiation?
I'm not sure yet, but I think I'll have a better idea to answer that on November 9th. I think the congressional ballot question is, based on history a little bit, it can be a little funky because this is not a national election. These are local elections in the House. And to a degree, they're local elections in the Senate. But I believe Republicans would be most content with even a 1 or 2 point lead on that ballot, because history would show when that situation is paired that way, they do very well.
And finally, just want your thoughts on the independent or libertarian candidates throwing a curveball in some of these races. That Ohio Predictive Insight poll that came out that gave the Libertarian Senate candidate in Arizona double digits, that seems to be eating into Republican candidate Blake Masters' numbers. And in Oregon, a former Democrat running as an independent there, Betsy Johnson, she's also got double digits in polling. And that seems to be pulling from the Democratic candidate. I know they won't likely win, but they say their candidacies allow them to talk about issues that aren't being discussed enough. Do they? Are they? Is that a way to just get your platform in there? Or is the fact that we're seeing like significant polling for some of them some sort of indicator to us?
I think in the Oregon case is very interesting, actually. You don't have to get to 50%. There are three major candidates. All of them are women. So you got a Republican in Christine Drazen, you got a Democrat, and you got an independent who used to be a Democrat. She could very easily take votes away from the Democrat running on the ticket. If that would be the case, they would split that vote, and Drazen, the Republican, has a chance of winning that election. So that's how a third party candidate could affect the race in Oregon. You mentioned Arizona. I think you make a good point there. There was that poll that came out that showed an independent getting anywhere between 5 and 9%. If that were to continue, it could have a significant drag on Blake Masters and keep him below the margin that he needs to beat Mark Kelly. But we've seen these independent candidates have an effect on elections in profound ways, not just at the House level or the Senate level, but in 1992, Ross Perot was the most successful third-party candidate in American history, you could argue. He had 19% of the vote, and to this day, Republicans believe that he was the reason why George H.W. Bush was unable to secure a second term, and Bill Clinton won. So they can really make a difference, especially, I would argue, in tight races like you mentioned in Arizona.
One more finally for you, Bill. Abortion. Have Republicans like Adam Laxalt in Nevada Senate race and Amanda Adkins in Kansas District 3 and others like them done an effective enough job of saying, look, abortion is settled where we are. It's in the state law or the state constitution, so it's a non-issue here. Or are people still going to vote based on their anger over that? Is that still pretty motivating?
I'm not sure how to answer that yet because I haven't seen the results. But here's what I think is important about the abortion question going into election night. There are four states with it on the ballot, similar to what Kansas did in August. And that's California, and that's Michigan, and that's Vermont. Kentucky has it on the ballot, but they're asking a different question about abortion. It could have an effect.
And Montana, I believe.
It could have an effect. You mentioned Kildee and Slotkin a few moments ago in Michigan. There are those in Michigan who believe the abortion issue will help people like Alyssa Slotkin win in her district. And she runs in Lansing in central Michigan and could help Dan Kildee, the Democrat in Congressional District 8, which is Flint, Michigan, just to the northeast of where Slotkin is living and running. And that could have an impact. That's something we'll watch. The other area of the country, I think, is Southern California. A lot of really competitive races around the Orange County area. And we'll see whether or not that referendum matters. There are other national polls that will suggest that abortion continues to drop the closer we get to Election Day. And that may continue or it may reverse itself again. But we'll just have to see. And we'll know what the voters tell us. And then we'll be able to draw some conclusions.
Phil Hemmer, thanks so much for joining us.
Jessica, thanks for your time.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, the January 6th committee voted to serve former President Trump, approving a subpoena for him to testify about the Capitol riot. Fox News congressional correspondent Chad Pergram and White House correspondent Jackie Heinrich chat about the week that was from both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. And you know Ohio will be a make or break state on Election Day, key for control of the Senate. Ryan Schmelz chats with a political scientist about the issues driving the races in the Buckeye State. Until then, I'm Jared Halpert. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.